Hey there, it's Shamitha here. A quick note, this episode was recorded before President Joe Biden's historic announcement that he will be dropping out of the 2024 race and is endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris. As our guest notes, this totally changes the playbook for the Trump campaign, but there's still lots to learn from how the campaign has operated so far and the vision they have for a Trump presidency. So keep that in mind as you listen. Thanks. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamitha Basu. Today, the confidence of the Trump campaign. There's still about 4 long months to go before the general election. But at the Republican National Convention this week, members of the GOP were already taking victory laps, seeming to anoint Donald Trump not just as their party's nominee, but also as a man blessed by a higher power.
Let me start by giving thanks to God Almighty for protecting President Trump.
God Almighty intervened because America is one nation under God, and he is certainly not finished with President Trump.
The devil came to Pennsylvania holding a rifle, but an American lion got back up on his feet, and he roared!
Is anybody in this room ready to send Donald Trump back to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
God bless Donald J. Trump.
Political conventions are always full of bluster and grandstanding. You can see how the dial gets turned up after a party's candidate survives an assassination attempt. But the unification around Trump this week has been striking. This is the candidate who led them to a surprise victory in 2016, who lost the general election in 2020 and refused to concede, who many hold responsible for the events of January 6th, who endorsed a bunch of Republican candidates in the 2022 midterms who went on to lose. But this week, the RNC showed that any concerns the party might have had about sticking with Trump seemed to be well in the rearview mirror.
The convention almost felt like the start of an election night victory party. I mean, it was just that sort of jubilant, euphoric vibe that was in the air.
That's Tim Alberta. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and has covered the Republican Party for years. This year, he's been embedded with the Trump campaign, talking to his strategists and getting a sense of what's different and what's not this time around. I spoke to Tim earlier this week as the convention was kicking off, just days after Trump's assassination attempt.
Republicans already knew that they were winning before the events of the weekend. And I think at just sort of a visceral gut level, they recognize that now they're really winning. That, you know, the scene that unfolded there in Pennsylvania and Trump sort of getting up defiantly with the blood on his face and pumping his fist and the crowd chanting USA. I mean, the central visual contrast that Republicans hope to make in this campaign is about strength versus weakness. And it is tactical, it is strategic, it is at the sort of beating heart of what the campaign wants to do against Joe Biden. I think the second thing I would point to is almost, I want to be careful with how I say this, but there was almost like a bit of a metaphysical, even messianic air to the proceedings. A lot of talk about Trump as almost being sort of invincible and someone who is righteously protected by God in this moment. I think Trump already, let's face it, had this sort of cult of personality command of the Republican Party. And, you know, that seems to almost be turned up a notch or two here at the convention after the events of Saturday.
You know, Tim, I've been thinking so much about our last conversation. Last time you and I sat down was to talk about your book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, which is all about evangelicals and support for Trump. What do you see happening here as Trump is himself invoking this kind of religious language?
Well, let me say first, I think people close to Trump, who I've talked to in these last couple of days, who tell me and have told others, this has been reported a little bit, that he is seemingly very sincere in using some spiritual and religious language that they've never heard him use before. And I think, obviously, Donald Trump is such a known commodity. And for many of us, we sort of roll our eyes at the notion that suddenly at this late stage in his life that he could change. And I'm not suggesting that he has or that he will. I don't know any of that. But I've reported at some length in the past on how Trump has sort of privately disparaged or at least dismissed people in the evangelical world as being sort of easy marks and people who believe things and who cling to rituals that he finds totally unrelatable. And even as he has found the political utility in trafficking in some of the religious rhetoric, he himself has never used it in private. But that is the thing, again, just in these last few days, that apparently that he's been talking about God and that he's been talking about sort of the divine protection that he felt in that moment. So that's really interesting. If for no other reason, it's certainly interesting at a political level in that it does sort of, you know, further cement his relationship with an evangelical base that had already viewed him as something of a political martyr, as someone who was being persecuted and someone who they believed was sort of chosen and ordained for this moment in American life.
We heard so much of that type of messaging when Trump spoke on Thursday night.
There was blood pouring everywhere, and yet, in a certain way, I felt very safe because I had God on my side. I felt that.
Some had expected Trump's speech would be a unity message, but it ended up being a lot of the same Trump material we've heard before. It was like part two of his "I Alone Can Fix This" speech from 2016. He repeated his lie that the 2020 election was stolen and painted himself as a victim of persecution.
In that spirit, the Democrat Party should immediately stop weaponizing the justice system and labeling their political opponent as an enemy of democracy.
When I spoke with Tim earlier in the week before Trump's speech, he said multiple things can be true at the same time. Trump is both a victim of political violence and a contributor to it.
We need to operate in the real world here, and we are talking about someone who tried to sabotage the peaceful transition of power, who openly tried to stage a coup and stay in office after he was defeated in a free and fair democratic election. So on paper, definitionally, we are talking about someone who has, in the past, posed a threat to democracy and who has continued since his defeat to traffic in sort of brazenly anti-democratic and authoritarian curious rhetoric. So two things can be true at once, that the country is way overheated and has really gotten carried away with the sort of hyper-polarized negative partisanship that casts every election as a clash between the forces of good and evil. That is true. And what is also true is that Donald Trump has at times very clearly positioned himself in opposition to liberal democracy and to constitutional rule in America, including when he himself floated the idea of terminating the Constitution because of the supposedly rigged 2020 election.
Well, Tim, I want to pull back for just a moment and talk about this recent piece that you came out with, deeply reported. You spent months speaking with people who are very high up in Trump's campaign, including two campaign co-managers, Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita. I want you to tell me a little bit about these two people. And I think that in learning more about them, actually, there's so much insight, it seems, you've gained into how this campaign is being run that I think people will find very helpful in thinking about how this assassination attempt can be sort of a pivot point also in the whole campaign. So first of all, tell us about these two people. Who are they? What are they known for?
Sure. What's so notable about this Trump campaign is how, relative to his 2016 and 2020 efforts, this 2024 operation is very professional, very sophisticated. And that starts at the top with Susie and Chris. I think Susie is probably best understood as the person who has done more than anyone to make sure that this year we're not talking about Florida. I mean, for the last, you know, 20, 25 years at least, Florida has been the dominant battleground state, the premier swing state in American politics. Tim Russert, the, you know, famous, dearly departed Meet the Press host, used to always say on his show, Florida, Florida, Florida. Like, that's all that matters, right? And we don't talk about Florida in this campaign, and that's because Democrats have conceded it. And if you are wondering why they've conceded it, the simplest answer is Susie Wiles. She, as a Florida resident and Florida native, she has really, like, ruthlessly worked to increase the Republican Party's vote share among non-whites and has been so successful that Democrats have basically looked at the math and said, we can't win here anymore, at least not until we do some sort of major course correction of our own. So Susie Wiles is very good at what she does. And then her partner on the campaign is a guy named Chris LaCivita. And Chris is kind of most famous for having led the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign back in 2004 that really, in many ways, sabotaged John Kerry's hopes for the presidency. And if you recall, of course, John Kerry's great strength in that campaign was his biography as a decorated Vietnam veteran. And what Chris LaCivita did was he spearheaded this strategic advertising campaign that effectively took Kerry's greatest strength and turned it into his greatest vulnerability by questioning the nature of his service in Vietnam. And, you know, it should be said that this was really politics at its dirtiest and least honorable and most cynical. And yet it worked. Politics is really, you know, a bottom line business. And the bottom line with Chris LaCivita in that campaign and in so many of his others is that he wins. So what Donald Trump has done here is, after running two previous campaigns that were very disorganized and never necessarily had a unified theory of the case about how to win, he's now turned over his operation to two of the most well-respected and feared political operators in the country.
So what did they tell you themselves about what their strategy looks like?
Most of what we have spent all of these months talking about was how this campaign was not organized to beat a generic Democrat, but rather how it had been built from day one and really optimized from the bottom up to run a very specific race against a very specific opponent in Joe Biden, the president. And I think what's really interesting when you would sort of peel back the layers on that is the confidence, the swagger, almost the arrogance you would get from Chris and Susie in these conversations and from their lieutenants on the campaign. I just can't remember ever being around a presidential campaign, including the Obama campaigns, where the people were so confident in what they were doing and so certain that they were going to win all these months out from Election Day. And when you try to understand the cause of that confidence, it rarely came back to Donald Trump himself. It had much more to do with Joe Biden, with who they were running against. And they believe, and obviously there's mounting evidence that they're right, that Joe Biden is just not electable And if you don't believe me, boy, just go to one of the swing states and talk to a vulnerable House Democrat or Senate Democrat about how this is playing in their communities. It's a huge problem. And so between inflation and immigration and then Biden's own personal issues as a candidate, the Trump campaign sees someone who is just operating at a position of such weakness and such disadvantage on paper that even if Trump, being as unpopular and disliked as he is, runs just a slightly above average campaign, then he should win.
And it sounds like in order to do that, they have some very specific strategies on how to deploy their field work, how to deploy a ground game in this election. And it's very unlike past campaigns. And I should also say there have been a lot of skeptics, even within the GOP, that this is the right campaign approach. But can you describe what they are doing, what they've laid out, and what they've told you their strategy is?
You know, one of the decisions that a campaign has to make is, okay, we have a finite supply of cash on hand. We've got cash constantly going out the door for just everyday expenditures of personnel and office space and those sorts of things. And then we have, you know, we have to earmark money for big expenditures like advertising. But this campaign is very unique in the sense that they've also had to worry about Trump's legal fees, which, according to different estimates, they have sucked anywhere from 25 cents to 33 cents of every dollar raised out of the Trump operations coffers to pay for his ongoing legal fights. This is a massive, massive expense that, you know, no other campaign I've ever covered has had to deal with. I think the other thing that people maybe haven't appreciated from the outside looking in is that the Trump campaign has been given orders from the very top, meaning from the candidate himself, that from day one, he wants to create this massive, unprecedented election integrity unit, basically a big nationwide network of lawyers and volunteers and people to be looking out over every precinct, every drop box, every tabulation center to ensure that there can be no fraud in this coming election. And that is another huge expense, something that most campaigns obviously would never have to account for in their budgeting. So Chris and Susie are looking at these numbers and saying, well, hold on a second. The math here ultimately doesn't work because you can't pay for all these legal fees and you can't pay for this huge election integrity operation and you can't also have money earmarked for advertising and simultaneously pay to build out a traditional ground game across the battleground states with hundreds of paid staffers and dozens of office openings. There's just not enough money to go around. And so what they had to do, Chris and Susie, effectively was almost disassemble the existing Republican National Committee's ground operations. And obviously, if this race winds up being close down the stretch this fall, and if Trump were to lose by a narrow margin, then Chris and Susie are not going to look very good. In fact, they're probably going to look like total fools because a ground game, a really good ground game, is known to be able to produce usually, according to a lot of studies on this, usually between 1.5 and 3 points as an advantage on the ground for a party that's really well organized and really hitting a lot of doors and doing that traditional work. So it's a big gamble that the Trump people are taking here, but honestly, they feel like they don't have a choice in taking that gamble.
And it does sound like this approach they're using, it's a very particular approach to identifying who is really a gettable voter. Can you talk a little bit more about that, the specifics of that, how they're thinking about recruiting these sort of third tier voters?
Yeah. So there are two theories that animate much of the Trump campaign's targeting operations. One is that despite the hyper-polarized nature of our politics, that there are still lots of voters who have not come off the sidelines for Donald Trump, but who they believe will in this election. And to be clear, that's kind of an eyebrow-raising bet to be making, because I think the consensus in the political class certainly was that after 2020, that Donald Trump had really maxed out his base. But this campaign doesn't believe that. They actually believe that there really is a critical mass of those voters still out there. So they have built a kind of volunteer-driven canvassing operation that's meant to replace some of the ground game that they have now sort of done away with. And what they're really banking on is this idea that Trump voters will be able to find some of these MAGA sympathetic people in their communities who, for whatever reason, have never voted for Trump before, but now are going to feel emboldened to do so this November. And that operation is basically built entirely on volunteers. So that's one sort of big strategic bet that they are making.
Yeah, and low cost.
Yes, that's right. Very low cost. Right. It's sort of a bargain bin targeting strategy, if you will. It's really not built on paying people. It's built on harnessing existing intensity among Trump voters and hoping that they can then channel that into free work on behalf of the campaign. And, you know, we're going to see if it's successful, obviously, come fall. But there are a lot of Republicans on the ground in some of these battleground states, and certainly in some tough purple districts, who just, they aren't sold on this. They question how effective a lot of volunteers with no real organizing experience in their communities can really be. What they want is the money, the resources, the manpower to run a traditional canvassing operation. And I think the other bet that the Trump people are making is that they are going to win significant chunks of traditionally Democratic voters this fall. And specifically, we're talking about Black and Latino men under 40. The Trump people believe that this election will be a realignment along lines of class, where there will be a multiracial working class coalition that emerges and comes together to vote Republican in ways that we've never seen before.
The Trump campaign says it'll be able to win over those swing voters by using micro-targeted media, like ads on Instagram and Facebook, not a massive door-knocking operation. And the campaign told Tim they won't be working too hard to reach suburban women. As one person put it, for every Karen we lose, we're going to win a Jamal and an Enrique. La Civita told Tim he believes there are four true battleground states: Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Trump's pick of Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as his running mate is seen as a way to help secure some of those Midwestern voters.
To the people of Middletown, Ohio, and all the forgotten communities in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and every corner of our nation, I promise you this: I will be a vice president who never forgets where he came from.
A big reason the Trump campaign is so confident in a much more targeted strategy is because they have something the Biden camp simply doesn't: very energized supporters.
The one thing we know about the Trump base is that they are intense, that they are highly motivated and enthusiastic. And I've traveled around the country with the Trump folks, and you can see it. I mean, they obviously have a huge advantage over Joe Biden in that department. They do have a lot of people who sign up and who volunteer and who tell the campaign that they want to be involved. I think the question is, can the campaign, which is in the process, really, of building out this brand new thing, can they, in real time, both build it out and organize these people and sort of get them where they need to be and have these people execute something that's never been done before, all in the space of just a few months?
Another big X factor is the Democratic nominee. The Trump campaign told Tim that Joe Biden is, quote, a gift. So much of their strategy is predicated on him staying in the race and being the nominee. Just listen to Trump campaign political director James Blair on The Ringer's podcast, Somebody's Gotta Win, with Tara Palmieri.
I think what's important is to look at what the numbers are telling us right now. And that is, in any poll you look at, if you look at folks who, you ask, who'd you vote for in 2020? President Trump consistently gets 95%+. So virtually all of anybody who voted for him in 2020 and then some. Biden is lucky to crack 90 in any of those numbers. And then there's, you know, downstream underlying numbers underneath that that also show a huge enthusiasm advantage for President Trump over President Biden. President Trump's voters want to turn out and vote. Joe Biden's voters aren't that interested in turning out to vote. So the Democrats really have two problems. They have to not only shore up their base and expand their coalition, but they also have to get them out to vote in the face of disinterest.
Blair also said in that interview that while Republicans are confident, they aren't counting their chickens before they hatch.
You never know. Anything could happen. We could be looking at a historic election, you know, whether we do or not. Look, I mean, we campaign like we're 10 points down everywhere. We are not complacent. The president is not complacent. We take nothing for granted. We know politics can shift quickly.
But Wiles and La Civita told Tim, if their strategy works, and that is a big if, they are predicting a blowout win in November. A blowout so big they destroy Democrats' chance in down-ballot races and usher in Republican victories at every level of government. And they felt this way even before the assassination attempt on the former president.
They feel like it's kerosene poured on a fire, and that people who were willing to crawl over broken glass for Donald Trump before, now it's just that much more dramatic, their devotion to him, their commitment to him, and their willingness to do whatever, whether that's donating money or knocking doors or making calls or whatever, you know, whatever it is.
You know, that makes me think about the part of your piece where you're talking about, after having spent all this time speaking with Trump's campaign managers and really trying to understand where they are coming from, you write that you worry that they haven't actually thought through what the consequences of winning might be. What do you mean by that exactly?
You know, the folks who worked for Donald Trump in 2016 were really just along for the ride and felt like they were part of an experiment in real time. What if this guy gets elected? How would he govern? What would he do? Who would he surround himself with? You know, what would his reaction be when the chips were down or when people turned on him or when there was some crisis in the country? All of those were question marks. We, in many cases, got the answers, and the answers weren't always pretty. And obviously, the culmination of that first term with the events of January 6th are a stain on this country and on its history. And, you know, there's no avoiding January 6th in these conversations with people who are helping to get Trump elected. There's no avoiding the fact that he hosted an avowed white supremacist neo-Nazi for dinner at Mar-a-Lago. There's no avoiding the fact that he posted on social media about terminating the Constitution. I mean, these things happened. And there's just, I think, a certain degree of compartmentalizing that's necessary for anyone working in a campaign. But I think in my conversations with a lot of Trump's people on the campaign, I kind of prompted them to pause and to reflect a little bit. And I did sense a certain degree of ambivalence at times and even some concern about, okay, well, we win, great. What comes next?
Tim, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Shmita. Thank you for having me back.
You can read Tim Alberta's reporting for The Atlantic on Apple News. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.